For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so tonight we are applying this concept of wisdom, which is really what James is all about. James, in some ways, it's like kind of taken right out of the Old Testament, out of like Proverbs or something like that, because he's all about trying to figure out what does it mean to kind of think God's way about the key things of life, which is that's what wisdom is. It's not just a matter of knowing a lot of things. That's knowledge. That's important. But wisdom is this practical ability to kind of see things from God's perspective. And so we've been talking about this for a couple of chapters now. And in chapter 5, James applies this idea of kind of seeing things from God's perspective to the area of affluence. And this was an issue in the early church. And there's a cultural dimension here that I think is important for us to kind of get at before we get into the passage. And the cultural dimension is that unlike America or the West in general, where we really have a vital middle class, right? So we've got a lot of rich people, and sadly, we have a lot of poor people in our culture. But right at the center, and really where more people than any are at, is that middle class. Where people kind of have a forward orientation, where our needs are met. We have even a little bit more to do things that we want to do. This kind of thing. In the ancient world, it really wasn't that way. There was really no such thing as a middle class. Either you owned and controlled, or you were owned and were controlled, basically. And so, in fact, in the Roman Empire, the number of slaves actually outnumbered the number of free people. And so there are these radical extremes of wealth in the society, and it should not be surprising to us that also then within the church, as the church is being established and people are coming in, those same social places that they came from are taking root in the church, and it's creating some dissonance. And so in chapter 2, for instance, James has had to say, hey, we got a problem in our group, people giving favoritism to the rich at the expense of the poor. That's not God's way. And then so after a couple chapters, James loops right back around and he begins to address this issue of affluence. And we want to apply some of these principles to our own situation. Let's take a look. Pretty hard-hitting stuff. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries which are coming upon you. So he's not mincing words. Your riches have rotted, and your clothes have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. Wow! It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. And this is, again, this is a technique that James has been using throughout his letter, and you see it in the teaching of Jesus. You see it in the Old Testament as well. Jewish teaching, wise teaching, wisdom teaching uses exaggeration, uses super colorful language, things like this to arrest our attention on the thing that he's trying to drive us at. And that's clearly going on here. He says in verse 4, behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your heart in a day of slaughter. You've condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. So there you have the black and white world, James. And he's just going to, we got a problem, he's saying. The problem deals with affluence. That's really what it's about. Come now, you rich, he says. And what we want to get an understanding of here tonight is what is it that James is talking about? What are those underlying things that really, in an appropriate way, really speak also to our situation? So, okay, let's just begin with this. He says, come now, you rich. Well, what does it mean to be rich? What is affluence? And I guess in just the simplest way, it means that you have resources beyond your needs. You have the ability to meet the real needs of yourself, your family, and then you've got some extra as well to to save or to spend on things that you don't really need to have, but what you'd like to have, like a nice chair right there in the front with a cup of coffee. That affluence comes from a variety of factors, and a lot of affluence comes just because we happen to be in an affluent culture. It's easy to become affluent once a culture has gained a certain measure of affluence, and our capacity to seize those opportunities depends to a large extent on things like our intellect, our education, certain things about our personality. Some of us are really driven to accomplish, others less so, and all these things end up getting measured actually in financial terms, in terms of affluence, and where we start in culture also has an effect on that. And it's interesting in the census data that came out from the 2010 census has shown a widening gap between rich and poor in our culture. For instance, that white Americans have a net worth as a household 20 times that of our African American counterparts. It's a widening gap. And that's been disturbing to some. We've been wondering, what are the factors that contribute to affluence or the lack of affluence in our culture? It's not an insignificant issue, because affluence is not neutral. From the biblical point of view, certainly, the idea of wealth is a good, and it has great potential also for evil. And spiritually speaking, it's a very volatile substance. And Jesus so puts it like this, in a warning, he says in Matthew 19, verses 24 and 25, he says, I tell you the truth, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I say to you, it is easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Wow. Now, again, Jesus, like James, is using this exaggerated language of Jewish hyperbole to make his point. You know, the thought that a camel could fit through the eye of a needle is, of course, an absurdity. A needle's eye is teeny. You know, you just put a piece of thread through that. Camels, last I heard, had real big heads. So the image is just kind of a ludicrous image, and that's kind of Jesus' point. And he's saying, look, you know, wealth is a huge, huge barrier to the things of God. And some of the reasons why that is, James has identified actually in this paragraph, in which we need to look at. We're going to unpack that a little bit. But our question here then needs to be, who is he talking about? Who's James talking about here? Who are these affluent? These must be people who are just of a magnitude of many fold more wealthy than their counterparts. But notice he says, come you who are rich. So these are not just some abstract entities. These are people within the groups that James is writing to. And so there really are these gross inequities of wealth that he feels that it is absolutely vital to speak to. And so I thought, okay, now what does that mean then? Is that who in contemporary application, who are we really talking about here? Are we talking about Donald Trump? Are we talking about, who else is a famous, like, gazillionaire? Okay, y'all got the idea. I heard a bunch of different names from different places, so okay, it's fairly well-trod ground. So James must be talking to those guys, right? Maybe. Or not. Let's think about this just a little bit. A number of years ago, we were doing some study and some work on poverty, and I have a friend who's a graphic artist. I asked him to help me out to kind of identify some things. At this time, on Sunday night, before we had planted out the Westside group and the campus group, we had about 600 adults. So we're going to use that as sort of the bottom line for, okay, what if the 600 adults on Sunday night represented the world? What about the distribution of wealth, like in this room? And so, all about 40%, a little bit less than 40% of the room, so it would be like Shelley on up through John. We'll kind of cut him in half because he's a little in the way, and right up through there, right where Dan is in the back. Wave your hand, Dan. There you go. See, okay, everybody over there, Povertyville. That means that your household income is about $430 a year. A year. 40% of the world lives in that place. If you go to the large favelas of Sao Paulo or Rio de Janeiro, the slums of Mumbai, India, large swaths of Africa, Haiti. A lot of us have been down there. 1 million people living in semi-permanent refugee status in their own country, living on about a buck a day. That's poverty. That's deep poverty. And here are people who are, you know, everything that they're doing is for the sake of survival. The thought of education, not an option for their children. Advancement economically, not going to happen. A house, are you kidding? Fresh water, I wish. Here are people who are living on just the kind of edges of survival. It's what economists call the desperately poor. And a lot of our world, my friends, are made up of you guys over here. And so, you know, their world kind of looks like this. It's a slum that's it's required even for enough nutrition, for brain development, things like that, to have help. They will die without that. It's like if you look in the news today, the whole discussion of Somalia, it's very much like that. Desperate, desperate poverty. 40% of the world is in that place. Then there is a place of what we're going to call slum town, and that's almost, again, another 40%. That takes us from, where are we at here, Cody, on up and over. Right, gonna cut you right in half, Tom. Right there. Back to Patrick in the back. Wave your hand, Mike. There you go. So all of you people live in slum town, which means that your family income is pressing in there at a little over $1,000 a year, $1,400. You're a little over $1,000 a month, or $100 a month. That means that most of your children will have the food that they need for their brains to develop normally. Maybe one, possibly a couple of your kids will actually be educated, at least to a certain level. You may be in a position to own a small plot of land, and you can live in your little one-room building. Now, any shift in the economy is going to put you right down into Povertyville, like right now. These are people who are on the margin of sustenance, on the margin of existence, and between Poverty Town and Slum Town, we're talking about an enormous majority of the world that we live in. An enormous majority of the world that we live in. Then there are others that we've kind of referred to as second world, which would be like maybe the remnants of Eastern Europe, parts of the former Soviet Union, modern-day Russia, the southern Mediterranean basin. There are some places like that, a lot of Latin and South America. We fit into this category here where we have a standard of living much higher, $5,000 per household per year. And now here, there is that ability often for education, for a way forward, for our children, some things like that. Maybe even at this level, we'll have access to at least the rudiments of medical care. Whereas, of course, the other ones would not. And so that's better. Then we could move up to a place that we all love and know is Pleasantville. That would be about 18% of the world's population, starting with Tyndall and working our way over there to Mike Olson and everybody in between. Stand up, y'all. We want to see how cool you really are. There you go. There's Mike. Tyndall's right there. Come on, let's see the scope of things here. Okay, so it's like this. How envious we are. of you. Oh, $26,000 of household income is what defines the top 18% of the world's population. That's Western Europe, that's the United States, and some pockets here and there, other places. Did you know that $25,000 a year for a household of four is the poverty level in America? It is. Odd scale. It's a perspective here that I'm trying to share with you. The thought that the top 18% of the world's population comes in at a household income of $26,000 a year. Actually, the reality is that for the vast majority of the households here tonight, we're not in at the $26,000 level. Probably not many of us at the $50,000 level, or the $75,000, or the $100,000, or more. We are many times more wealthy than the wealthiest of the wealthy in the world. And for that reason, there's a certain sort of vertigo that comes by looking at our exalted plateau. It's really hard looking down from where we are to even conceive of the mass of misery that exists below us. And yet, there it is. The poverty line in our country, in relation to the average household incomes of 82% of the world. That's remarkable. Come now, you rich. Well, my friends, that would be us. That would be us. Living at a level of wealth unimaginable in James's world. Incredible. The poorest of us are many times more wealthy than virtually any other place on the planet. And that is important for us to understand the scope of the thing. I like that graphic very much. If it was telling the truth about where most of us are, that Pleasantville would be four times higher than it is. Three times for sure. Out of sight, up beyond the clouds. Hard to imagine. And James says, come now, we who are rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. And so what I want to do is I want us to think a little bit about affluence, as James does here, as a spiritual issue. And I want to think about it in terms of four pressure points that James brings up in this paragraph. Four things about wealth that are very dangerous indeed. Wealth can be a great blessing. The Bible's not against wealth, but the Bible is very realistic about the power of wealth among fallen people like you and me. And so the first is, he says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries which are coming upon you. How ironic that must have been for James's readers in the ancient world. To possess wealth would be a sign of God's blessing. Well, I must be doing something right after all. Look how I'm living. And so you have that sense, that feeling that somehow God must be with me. The universe is cooperating and has selected me perhaps in some way, because look at the stuff that I have. That's how the world thinks, for the most part, about wealth, and that if I don't have it, what have I done wrong? It's sort of a karma principle that operates the way the world thinks about these things. And James, in a very ironic twist, says, you who are rich, not so much in this place of blessing. He says, there's a misery that he's describing here, that there are empty promises of wealth, things that we look for in wealth that wealth itself cannot deliver. And so Jesus says, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. I like that word in the Greek. It's pleonexia. It sounds kind of like a disease. Got a bad case of pleonexia, you know, just can't get it off of me. Yeah. And it sort of has that meaning too, that there's a compulsion here. This drive to own, to possess, something that preoccupies our thinking It's what we're about. It's what defines success for us. That's what he's talking about when he uses the term greed. It's a virtue in our culture. And he says, for, and the reason is given then. This is great. The reason. For, not even when one has in abundance, does his life consist of his possessions. Well, that's just a very important point. An important point for those of us, most of us in many ways, subconsciously or not, who tend to define ourselves by our possessions. The things that we have accomplished and the things that we have amassed, these things are tributes to our greatness in various ways. And Jesus is saying here in Luke 15, he says, not even when a person has an abundance of stuff does his soul, does his life consist in his possessions. In other words, you can amass all you want, but since there's no measurable correlation between affluence and happiness, Jesus is making the point here that affluence is really not worth the sacrifice. And so we've got a sickness in our culture, this thing, this pleonexia, this greed. It's the ideal of acquiring new, better, faster, nicer, more as a way of defining who I am and why I matter and what is significant for me. And we are willing as a culture to sacrifice all things on the altar of our pleonexia. There are some facts here that are significant. For instance, if you compare 1960 census with 2010 census on household work, the average American household works today more than twice as much as the generation that preceded us. More than twice as much. We're working twice as hard. Of course, we're living in houses that are twice as big. The footprint of the house built in the 2000s is twice the size of the houses built in the 50s and early 60s. It's amazing. And we are willing to work these crazy hours to imperil our health, to ignore our children to a large extent. Why? Well, because we need to succeed. And so, for instance, we're in this tither these days in America. The realization has come to us, oh my goodness, this may be the first generation of Americans who are not as affluent as their parents. Oh my God. It's all over. The dream is gone. And so we are kind of laboring under this kind of mirage about what wealth is, knowing that from social science and from the scripture, they converge on this point, that there is no measurable correlation between your level of affluence and the extent of your happiness. It's just an established fact. Once you get beyond significant levels of poverty, more wealth does not advance your happiness. This is the lie that we've been brought up with and that we have adopted as a culture, and we've internalized as individuals, and that is a problem for us. There is a hidden assumption about affluence as well, namely that there's a hook along with it, and it is that wealth seeks our devotion. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, this is Matthew 6, he says, where your treasure is, there will your heart lay also. No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and wealth. And what he's saying here is that what you are about, what you treasure, what you value, just it has a hold on you, and it calls to you, and it conforms you into what it is about. Man, think about this. Where is your head at? What do you think about? What do you fantasize about? What makes you happy? You know, when we define those things in material terms, we have bought into the lie of the world, and we are giving ourselves over. We are pouring out our lives for the sake of this assumption that wealth is the key to happiness. Where your treasure is, Jesus says, is going to call your heart to that place. And there's implications for that we need to talk about here in a minute. But one thing, by way of warning and way of applying this principle, given the inherent power of wealth, the inherent power of wealth to call and to shape and to mold our aspirations and our hearts, the affluent, namely us, except for, the affluent must be very clear about how we are serving God with our lives. That level of clarity needs to be there more for us than anyone else in the world, because the competition for our hearts is so great because of the culture that we live in, this culture of comfort, this culture of everything's cool, this culture that says, just have a little more, just have a little more. And so that's where our heads are at. If we're not actively taking a stand to say, you know, what I really am about is serving God with my life, this will inevitably, my friends, inevitably overcome us and absolutely neutralize our effect. Study after study after study has shown, from Gallup to all the major survey organizations, have shown that in the area of cultural values, what people live for and the standard by which they live and why they make the decisions they do, as is measured by house size, car purchases, education, divorce, things like that, the evangelical church in America is not statistically different than anybody else. Not significantly different than anybody else. And I'm telling you, this is something, this is the power of the world system bearing in on us. And the only way that we're going to have sanity about our financial lives is to be about something that's not finance driven. It's about the things of God. Well, we'll return to that here at the end. Another point here then, too, in verse 2, he says, okay, your riches have become moth-eaten, your riches have rotted, your clothes have become moth-eaten, your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. Unpleasant. Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about hoarding. You have all this stuff. You have so much stuff, he says. It's like you can't even spend it. Your gold is just piling up. It's rusting. You know, gold doesn't rust. Gold doesn't rust, does it, Steve-O? It does not rust. So, again, this is an exaggeration. He's saying it's so long, you've got so much stuff, it's like you could never really spend it. All your cool clothes, the moths have gotten to it. You know, you got more shoes than Imelda Marcos. Kind of what he's saying. Amassing stuff is what he's saying here. Amassing stuff is an empty legacy. These are a witness against you, he says. You amass all this stuff, and that's an empty legacy compared to what true wealth is. Generosity, relational success, purposeful living. Well, you know, that's where real wealth is. That's what really satisfies. That's what where success is found, and not just piling up more metal or material, but in being able to invest ourselves generously in the meeting of other people's needs, and in having real relationships that actually work, where we're coming together, we're serving and loving one another, where we're living for a purpose greater than our pocketbook. And man, I think as parents, this is such a very important piece, because the pressures that we have on our kids to succeed, you know, to just to be better than, to compete, to do all the right things so they can get into all the right schools and get all the right jobs. And why? To make all the right money. And that's what's, and the pressures of coaches and teachers and everything around us is really difficult, I think, often for our own children to navigate through that. And a lot of us have struggled in this area. Some of us have really bought into this rap. It was keep them busy so that they won't be into sex and drugs. And keep them busy and successful in school so that they'll do well in life. And what are we doing here, folks? We're just thinking like everybody else. And we're caught up in the machine. Instead of saying what really matters, you know, kids don't care where they grow up. They don't care how big the size of their bedroom is. What they care about is parents who are engaged with them, who are teaching them how to be successful in relationships with other people, to learn what does it mean to practice forgiveness. What does it mean for me to serve somebody who can't serve me back? What does it mean for me to think about my life as a stewardship of that I've got something to offer the world that really matters? That is success in parenting. We've got some things, if we're all about stuff, and our kids are going to learn from us a lot more by what we do than by, right, what we say. So we've got an opportunity here to show what real wealth is, not the stuff that can be moth-eaten and rust, but something that really matters. It's a values issue, it's a spiritual issue, and there is competition for your heart on this point. Third, behold, he says, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. Okay, so here's a different point. This is about exploitation versus relationship. He's talking about the withholding of pay. This is interesting. A number of years ago, I was down in Brazil along the Amazon River, and there was a village about 1,000 miles inland called Santarém, and in it are most of the homes that are built there are made out of this real lightweight clay brick with lots of holes in it. Why? Because it's so hot down there, but they want lots of air to circulate. And it was cheap, too. You can buy these things for not very much money. And we went to a brick baking factory out in the middle of the jungle. And here it was, there are these kids, 8 to 12 years old for the most part. Most of them were this way. And they are carrying hundreds of pounds of clay back and forth from big pits to these places where they're like, you know, those Play-Doh machines that you stick all the goop in and you go like that, and it shoots out a shape, right? And that's what they did. And then they had a guy with a machete, and he's like, whack, 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 whack. And then into the oven they go, and they get baked, and they get cooled, and then the same kids are like taking them to a flatbed boat, and upstream it goes, and they're for sale. And here was the weird thing about that. Those kids worked 16-hour days for the most part. They are working really hard. And they never made a dime. Because why? Well, because the owner, every month, would sell his company to a relative. And so when they come up and it's time to get more bricks, they'd be like, well, hey, we didn't get paid for the last ones. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm really sorry to hear about that. That was somebody else's company, but not mine. So I can't pay you for somebody else's company, but I'll pay you for this. And then the next month it would be, you know, the same thing. It would just go around like that. And these kids were what? What would we call them today? They're slaves. They're slaves. And that is what James is talking about, exploitation. The worker laboring and not being compensated for their work. And that's a sin. God is upset about that. We don't possess wealth in a vacuum. We possess wealth in a limited range of resources. And if we are unjust, we are taking from that other person what they need. The Bible is clear that we are accountable for the just distribution of God's resources. As one of the main themes that runs through the Old Testament, what was wrong with Israel? It was that they were unjust with the poor and with the vulnerable. And James is bringing his readers attention to this reality. We are responsible and we are accountable to God for the just distribution of the things that God in His sovereignty has chosen to give to us. We'll give an account. Matthew 25. You stand before God and Jesus says, you know, I was in jail and you didn't visit me, and I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was naked and you didn't clothe me. And all these religious folk are like, oh yeah, we never saw you in those conditions. And Jesus is like, well, yeah, but see, in as much as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me, my brothers. It's a big deal. And so we need to think about that. John puts it this way in 1 John 3. He says, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for one another. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in that man? For John, it's inconceivable that a person who claims to know God is unwilling and callous to the physical needs of his own brothers. Incomprehensible. We are accountable for the just distribution of the resources that God has in his graciousness allowed us to have. And that brings us then to our final point. He says in verse 5, you live luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. He says, you fattened your hearts for a day of slaughter. You condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. I wonder, do we hear James's warning? You've lived luxuriously on the earth. A life of wanton pleasure. Man, pick up a magazine. Watch a commercial. And this is what our culture is telling us that we're entitled to and that we ought to pursue with all that we've got, with all the gusto that we've got. And James is like, you know, it's like a pig down there in the trough and, eating as much slop as possible, thinking, man, I got a great, this guy is awesome. Little short-sighted. He's off the slaughter. And James is like, you know, that is just the way it is with that short-term perspective of I've got to get what I can get for me or whatever. And it's just like you don't understand the big picture here. And I wonder, do we hear James's warning? And what a unique opportunity we really have. This is a burden that has been on my heart for a long time, so I'm going to burden you with my burden here. That I believe that the Lord, in His mercy and His sovereignty and His graciousness, has allowed us to prosper wildly beyond the expectations of just about any place in the world, materially. So that, in those places in the world today where the gospel of Jesus Christ is expanding in incredible numbers, we can resource and fuel what they're doing. Where is the message of Christ growing today? It's growing in great poverty. It's growing in Povertyville, in slum town, in desperate places in Africa, in Asia. There are more Christians living underground in China than exist in America. All manner of places where there is great need. And God has raised us up with the privilege, with the opportunity to partner with the world and to resource the world that is experiencing an explosion, a spiritual explosion unlike anything we have seen, certainly in our generation, maybe over the last 100 years. It's remarkable. Missiologists, people who study missions, are clear that tens of thousands of churches are being established every week all over the world, and it's in this context of great poverty. And so God, I think, has given us an opportunity to share in the most awesome thing in the universe, the establishing of His kingdom in these dark places, in difficult places in Africa, in Haiti, where, again, you've got hundreds of thousands of people in utter destitution, but everywhere you turn, they want to hear about Christ, and they respond. And what do we do with that? And we have an opportunity to partner in a number of places to affect a significant, sustainable, long-term movement of God. We had some folks up last week from Haiti that we've been partnering with for several years now. And we began talking about what does this look like. And just having this vision of one city in southern Brazil that presently has one church and the potential for dozens of house churches all over the surrounding area and up into the mountains, and people are responding to Christ and to the message of Christ. They need some help. They need some resources. And we can supply those kinds of things. We believe that there are similar potentials in Indonesia and in other difficult, in Cambodia, where we have significant work going on. It's the same thing. We can partner with what God is doing there and participate, take what He has given us to invest there. And I'm very excited for that vision. To think about our group of however many hundred we are here tonight, to actually be catalysts for a group three times this size in the surrounding area of southern Haiti. People who are congregating and are together and are being trained and equipped and are really being the people of God because we've been able to help them do that. We can do this. We should do this. It's an opportunity. There's lots of opportunities like that. I'm not here to sell or whatever. I'm just saying let's expand our vision. Why has God chosen to give to you the extraordinary wealth that He has? So that you could steward it, so that you could give it, so that you could live generously. Let me make just a couple of points here in closing. Some vital signs, some signs of spiritual life that relate to this whole discussion. First, is there a sense of urgency in spiritual matters in your life? A sense that, man, today matters. There's a lot at stake. There are things going on. God's got a plan for me today, for my resources, for my life, my ability, my willingness to pursue that person that has become a person that I've cared about. And now I'm going to pursue that person. I'm going to care for them. I'm going to show them the love of God. We see that there are things at stake. That sense of urgency that today matters. That's a healthy thing. And you know what kills that? Material comfort. Material comfort says, yeah, urgency. Hit me again. You know, just kind of anesthetize ourselves into a blasé, tepid irrelevance as spiritual people. That is an effect of material pursuit. lack of real urgency. Other things just crowd in, they take over. How are we doing with that? Is there that sense of urgency that's animating your heart as you think about what God seeks to accomplish through you here tonight? What kind of gratitude are we driven by? Here I was thinking about this. Friday, I was invited out to lunch with a friend, and he paid the bill for my lunch. He bought me lunch, and I was grateful in a way that was like, that was a nice gesture. Thank you, even though certainly I could have done it myself, right? Well, that's not the kind of gratitude I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the gratitude where, like in the Lord's Prayer, where Jesus says to his disciples, hey, pray like this, you know, give us this day our daily bread. What kind of a prayer is that? That's the prayer of somebody on the margin. That's the prayer of somebody who's trusting God that they'll eat that day. That they'll eat that day. See, that's different. You see how it's different? It's a different kind of gratitude when they're provided something to eat. And I wonder, you know, just how hungry are we? Really? Spiritually? How much do we have that sense that I can't believe the goodness of God? I'm so grateful for what He's done. I'm just looking for the opportunity to share that, to give it away. You know, that's the whole thing about the Christian life, is that we're not motivated by a set of rules. Just do the right things. Just follow the plan, the however many steps or whatever it is. The seven habits, the five pillars, the eightfold path, whatever, you know, is out there. The Christian life at its core is a thank response to God because He met us. That He said, I love you. I want to have a relationship with you. I want to draw you into my kingdom, into my family. And there's a barrier here. There's a problem that stands in the way. And that problem is that you're not really my son, my daughter right now. You've gone your own way. You're an orphan. And I have paid through the cross of Christ to liberate you from your bondage to your sin and from yourself, and have through that enable you to come into my deal, my family, my kingdom. And all I'm asking you to do is just, you know, you come to that place and you realize I'm on the outside looking in. And I want to make this choice then to receive this provision of God through Christ, through the cross, that opens the door between myself and God. It's a decision that we make. Come on in, God is saying. The water's nice. And, you know, when we're at that place where we realize, you know, God's got something for me that I can't get for myself. I can't make myself alive to God. I can't make myself right before God. But He has chosen by His grace, by His mercy, to welcome me into His presence because of what He has done for me. You know, then it's like, oh, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful because I'm so aware of how far I am from Him. But I'm taking You at Your word, God. So I accept the terms. I accept Your death as my payment. And when we realize that, when we come to terms with the fact that God just totally forgives us, past, present, and future, that door is open, well, there's just gratitude is the natural response to that. It's like, You are awesome, God. And that becomes that motivation then to live for Him, to whatever we've got, we just want to move it in the direction of what He is doing. A vital sign here would be whether we have a narrow or broad world of concern. By a narrow world of concern, what I'm saying here is that we may find that we've got real problems in the area of affluence when our sphere of interest is so narrow that essentially it's really all about us. My predictable life, my stuff, and the people who make me feel good about being me. And that's, you know, that's where, again, so much of our culture is. We just want to live for that little niche that we can control. It's really all about protecting that. And yet where a person is really freed from the worries about their future and worries about, you know, my financial life or whatever, and it just has given themselves over to Christ to be used by Him and all their resources with them, tends to have a very broad view of the world. Their concerns are very broad. There's room for other people, their needs. I start hearing that voice. Their needs really are calling to me to sacrifice for their good. And material preoccupations keep us very much locked in our own private world of concern. We're just simply not interested in what's out there. Are you growing in this area? Are you growing in that sensitivity and that awareness of the real interests and the real needs of other people around you? And I'm telling you, to the extent that you're struggling here, as many of us are, I'm sure of it, materialism is in the way. You don't have to be rich to be a materialist. You can be poor as could be, but if you're looking to that, as that's what I'm really wanting, that's the answer for me, it's poison. Some of us are feeling real tight, like I'm barely making it. Yeah, I'm bringing in $85,000, but man, am I poor. It's really hard to imagine how a guy could make it on a salary like that. I'm going to have to borrow more and more and more and more. And that's really where we are at. You know, it's just that I've got to have, and I'm willing to put my responsibility financially on hold so that I can continue in having what I feel like I'm entitled to or whatever. And I'm always feeling tight. Can you imagine somebody living on a dollar a day trying to comprehend how we feel poor? It's inconceivable. It's grotesque. And so instead, the person who really gets it is the one who is aware of the blessing of their abundance and who just is prepared to be open-handed with it. Are we open or closed to wise counsel about our money? This is a real tough one. We don't talk about certain things, right? Like what? Politics is always bad. Well, money. Let's just say it. It's money. How much we make or what we do with that. And yet, see, so many people are in bondage in this area of our life. It's one of those secrets that we don't reveal. It's one of those taboo conversations that we may not go there. Are you open to wise counsel about your financial life? Do you have people that you are willing to talk to and say, hey, this is what I'm about with my finances. Am I self-deceived here? What do you think about that? You ever had a conversation like that? Put it out on the table and say, hey, what do you think? What do you think the Bible would say about this, you know, how I give or whatever? What I find is that most people are very guarded and protect this area of their life to their own detriment. And so there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of things like this going on. And the result of that is that people are just, they're being broken by their own lack of wisdom in this area. We should be as open about our financial lives as we are over many of the other areas of life. Maybe even more. Because why? Because it's such a crucially important spiritual area. To be open, to be taught to talk about that. To stimulate one another toward love and good deeds as it relates to our financial living. And lastly, you know, whether we are establishing a disciplined and sacrificial pattern of generosity in our life. Because this is where it ends. You know, we have a stewardship from God. We will answer to him for the use of our resources that he gave to us. And the question is not how much, really, I think. It's whether we're disciplined and sacrificial in our giving. Are we able to give in ways that might hurt? Might make me go without a little bit here. Just why? So that other people can have. And I think, you know, if we are really vital in these areas, we're going to stand out as a very different kind of community of believers. And we're going to be able to really make a difference. We're going to be able to fund and support things, come alongside works around the world that are just happening, that are awesome, and we have that blessing of participation in the gospel that Paul talks about. So there it is. That's the hard part of James. The rest of it is way easier, but it had to be said. So there it is.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.